My guest is Brando Benifei. He's an Italian MEP serving the third term in the European Parliament. During the previous mandate, he was co-rapporteur for the Artificial Intelligence Act, and thanks to this work, in March 2024, he won the prize for the best MEP of the mandate assigned by the Parliament magazine. Now he's a coordinator in the Committee on International Trade for the Socialist and Democratic Group and chair of the European Parliament's Delegation for Relations with the United States. He's a member of the Committee on Constitutional Affairs, and he also works as a substitute member on the Committees on Internal Market and Consumer Protection and on Legal Affairs, and still follows very closely all digital issues. Welcome to the podcast, Brando.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
See how much time we have. You're a busy guy. You're recording this while you're in the plenary in Strasbourg. You may be taken away, so I'll get cracking. I'll want to try and cover three things if you have the time, Brando. One is your work on the AI Act and more recently the Commission's new technological sovereignty package, and then move on to relations with the United States more broadly, since you're probably the MEP who goes to Washington, D.C. the most frequently. And then if
Definitely.
definitely, and then maybe the politics of the European Parliament, the shifting coalitions, is the thing that's been dogging the Parliament
Yeah.
since the 2024 European elections. Right. First of all, the AI Act, Brando. Obviously, a great piece of work by you and your colleagues in the European Parliament, but as you will know, quite severely criticized by some quarters for being intrusive, for stifling competition, just at the moment when Europe is trying to be more competitive. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Well, I think this criticism is mostly based on prejudices because I hear, for example, that this regulation would stop European companies from being on the same level playing field than with the other companies of the world that develop AI. But this is factually wrong because the AI Act applies to all companies that want to sell AI products in Europe is a product safety legislation. So, in fact, simply because today we have more developers that are outside the EU, it's more applied to companies that are not from the EU. Because the AI Act objective is to, in fact, create a context of trust in the adoption of AI by saying it clearly that we can check AI systems on parameters that define their safety. For example, the quality and appropriateness of data used to train based on what the system is for example, to avoid biases on systems that have to select curriculums and have sometimes, we know these cases, we have seen them, they learn to discriminate women, to exclude women from the selection process. Or cybersecurity risks, for example. Why should we have AI used in sensitive areas like public administration without clear cybersecurity guarantees? But also the governance of the data. When we use AI in healthcare, we want the data that are gathered from patients to be protected. They are very sensitive data. And also, we want to be sure about human control so that we do not lose control of the AI system. For example, you can imagine when it's used for the activities of a city, for a smart city powered by AI, you want to be sure that the AI doesn't go against the interest of the citizens because it hallucinates. So you need to have these parameters. In fact, this part of the AI Act is the one that will be implemented later because we are still working with the standards. So it will be fully implemented at the end of 2027. But today we already have, for example, prohibitions in place, prohibitions of AI use cases that are dangerous for our democracies. For example, mass surveillance through biometric cameras in public spaces in real time, predictive policing, social scoring Chinese style, biometric categorization. So I don't have time now to delve into all these examples, but just to say that we have prohibited use cases that are dangerous for the freedom of our citizens. And it's not that we invented something. Today, the debate between Anthropic and the Pentagon was exactly about that. It was about automated weapons, but also it's a quote from the press releases on this, also about using the systems to do mass surveillance on American citizens. In the EU, we have worked on that preemptively because we know that the governments could use AI to create forms of social control that are against the freedoms of the citizens. But also, we have implemented transparency. At the end of this year, we have in place a system to identify AI-generated content. So we want to avoid the deepfakes that are used today already for disinformation, for cyberbullying, for crimes of all kinds, will not be still unrecognizable. We want to be sure that AI-generated content becomes recognizable. And we want also to protect copyrighted material and so the creative sector. So these are just very briefly some examples of what the AI Act is dealing with. It's in the way of being implemented, but I'm sorry, all the criticism that we hear are either really not based on the AI Act or they are directed at real issues that have nothing to do with the AI Act. For example, the access to data. That's very important. In EU, you have an issue about having access to quality data, but this has nothing to do with the AI Act. And the
Right.
companies, and let me conclude on this, the companies that develop AI in Europe say it clearly. Always. I always say, get the same answer. What's your problem? The first problem is always the access to capital, having access to more funding. So we are in the urgent need of a more integrated financial market. They want more computational capability, and we are working on this with AI factories. We should accelerate on that. And thirdly, they say the complexity of the legal system. It's never the AI Act, but the complexity of the legal systems is always connected to the fact that the EU is fragmented. We have EU-level legislation, and then we have a lot of national implementation
Yeah.
that creates a lot of problems for the companies for compliance.
Well, I want to press you on that last point, Brando, because you just mentioned implementation. How confident are you that this AI Act, which obviously was the result of hours and hours of discussion and compromise, not just inside the Parliament, but the other institutions and all these stakeholders, of course, making representations to you, but now it's there. How confident are you that the member states will implement it in an expeditious and a timely manner, given, as you say, this fragmentation and how member states have quite a lot of leeway and freedom to implement or ignore as they wish?
So they can't ignore because the EU law prevails on national law. What they will try to do is to, in some cases, to try to get more space for interpretation. This is what they will try to do. But for example, on the usage of AI for surveillance mechanisms, because some governments want to be more able to use systems that are putting citizens under more control. We know that. We have seen that also during the negotiations. But we are confident that a strengthened European-level AI office for the implementation of the law. This is what we are working also now on to strengthen the capabilities of the EU-level implementation body will prevent this kind of behaviors. And until now, we have seen for these first phases of implementation quite a good implementation phase for especially for the prohibitions, because that's what we have been doing until now. That was the first part to kick in. But clearly, we need to strengthen centralized enforcement of the EU legislation. This is a broader topic, and it touches also upon the AI Act, because we cannot have EU-wide legislation and then fragmented implementation. When we choose to have EU-wide norms, they need to be implemented at the EU level. We cannot give the member states this fake sovereignty that in fact creates only confusion.
Right. Let's broaden this out a bit then, beyond AI and the AI Act, Brando. So just over a month ago, the European Commission came out with its technological sovereignty package, which is part of a bigger strategy, obviously, to compete with, in effect, or be make me self-reliant and less dependent on technologies from other parts of the world. What is your take on this package? How impressed are you by it? How much do you think it will go to solve some of the issues that Europe is now clearly facing in terms of its vulnerabilities.
So we are happy that the Commission has finally proposed a tax sovereignty package. This was requested by the Parliament already some time ago, because to be honest, this mandate started in 2024 with a strong push for simplification, which was also needed. We are happy on some of the simplification that was done. For example, also on the AI Act, we worked on it. We did this so-called AI omnibus that has changed and updated some aspects of the law to simplify the compliance for smaller businesses, but also to deal with some emerging issues like the explosion of non-consensual nudification AI programs. So we have banned, and it will be in place from December 2026, non-consensual nudification AI systems in Europe. There was a big scandal around the Grok AI, but also other systems that were used for this and for pedophilia or for violence against women. So I'm just saying we have started the mandate with this revision of legislation that has put a simplification, but also updating on some aspects like this one I mentioned. But now, finally, we are moving towards what we think is more urgent, which is building sovereign EU digital infrastructure. Because today we have too much dependency. This doesn't mean we need to become autarchical, that we abandon the cooperation with our allies. And obviously, we have a lot of work on this field with the US, especially, but not only. But we are not talking about protectionism. We are talking about creating European alternatives to not be dependent or even blackmailed. As I said in the plenary during these days, in a speech in my participation in the debate about the cybersecurity strategy of the EU, the kill switch has already been pressed. It's not a theory. Trump has shown that he can stop us from the access to advanced AI models when he banned Anthropic from letting non-American subjects to use the new versions of Mythos and Fable. This was the clear demonstration that we were not talking about theoretical problems, but real dangers of being cut off from technologies. And today on cloud, we have a 90% dependency on non-European cloud providers and 70% in Europe to three only providers, all from US. That's why in the tech sovereignty package, we have prominently the Cloud and AI Development Act, which is about strengthening the capacity of the European cloud industry. But we also have the CHIPS Act to strengthen supply chains on chips. We have an open source strategy to strengthen the use of open source technologies. So we are happy that the Commission is moving finally in that direction, but I can tell you that I'm already working with some colleagues to strengthen the proposals that will soon start their legislative work.
Right. Well, let's then move on to broader transatlantic relations. Brando, you referenced it just there with these actions by the White House vis-a-vis Anthropic, certainly, and other examples. This kill switch, as you call it. Just briefly, for the benefit of some listeners who don't follow detail, what is a delegation, in this case, the Delegation for Relations with the United States? And why did you take on the job as chair when it became available?
So I was always working on transatlantic issues in my past years, especially for this digital dialogue. So when I worked on the AI Act, but also on digital literacy and on other issues, I had the chance to have transatlantic dialogue quite frequently. And so I got probably through that lens, interested in working more broadly on transatlantic relations. I've always been interested in US. I've been many times before, not only for the digital, but for example, also participating in the last Democratic Party conventions, and also having cooperation, especially with the Democratic Party. Now, in fact, as chair of this delegation, I work more with the Republicans because they are majority party now in US, but always also with the Democrats. What do? We are a group of members of the European Parliament, led by me with other colleagues, that establishes the parliamentary dialogue, first of all, with the Congress, but also with all the institutions of the US. To mention specifically, for example, I had occasions to talk and have exchanges with a lot of different departments of the administration, from the trade representative to the commerce to the treasury to the State Department very often, and the White House, etc. And we also work with civil society and with stakeholders at large, think tanks in the US. So our objective is to maintain a dialogue between EU and US on various topics. For example, recently we have been focusing a lot on supply chain of semiconductors and critical raw materials. That's an area where the cooperation between EU and US is working. It's one of the areas where we have less friction compared to others. And so we have been working to build a constructive agenda for the transatlantic relations.
Is there an appetite still on the US side for engaging with the European, in this case, specifically the European Parliament? Even in the past, even under Democrat administration, there always seems to be more enthusiasm and keenness for MEPs to go over the pond to DC rather than the other way around. Is that a fair comment?
Well, this has changed a bit. To be frank, also next week I will meet with members of the House and the Senate of California, but also federal Congress members are coming much more often to Brussels compared to previous times, probably because in a moment where the executive level is bringing a lot of tension. In these days, we see Trump bringing up again the Greenland issue like he did before. And he's never stopping in creating tensions, to be frank. So probably that's also the reason why the Congress has been more active in coming to Brussels, but also at the same time, I would say more keen to have more in-depth discussions with us when we visit in DC, where I will be again in a few weeks also.
And you see the beginning, therefore, maybe already the reality of a strategy on two sides. If you say the executive is causing tensions, is this a new role, in effect, for your delegation and your counterparts in the Congress to engage in more constructive and cooperative discussions and collaboration, frankly?
Yeah, for sure, because clearly we see that there are many members also of the Trump party that do not agree with this stance that is more aggressive on Europe. If we look at topics like NATO or trade or in general approach on European democracy, we see differences even among the Republicans, because you could see in the National Security Strategy of the White House a clear on paper distrust of the European Union. So it's very clear. They say we should cooperate with Europe. We love Europe, but we hate the European Union. This is what you get it from reading that. And they advocate for a continental Brexit. This is very clear in that paper. It's not a phrase that was taken randomly. It's an official document of the administration. So these views are not shared also by members of Congress from the Republican Party, not only from the Democrats. And so we are building, especially on some topics like I can add also the attitude towards Russia. You have seen Trump being very open towards Putin and the administration in general. While in the Congress, you see more resistance to be so friendly with Putin. And this is something we work on.
Right. Well, let's finish off then, Brando, briefly with a discussion about the internal politics of the European Parliament. Of course, the elections took place, the most recent elections to the European Parliament took place just 2 years ago now. And there's been a lot of talk about shifting coalition. With this, for the benefit of our listeners, to remind people, this grand coalition of your group, Social Democrats, European People's Party, Centre Right, Liberals, the Green Group, I'm not sure I've left anybody out. And that was the kind of the broad centre, very broadly defined. But now there are clearly signs of new coalitions forming. with the EPP and groups to their right. How much of a trend do you think this is, and how worrying, if it is a trend, is it is for you?
It's a problem because on some topics, this majority, alternative majority to the right and extreme right, has materialized clearly. For example, on migration, that's the topic where you see the right wing coalition. Because on other topics, they are far away. For example, on Russia, there is still a part of the extreme right that has a strong tie with Russia. Or you have different views on the relations with Trump, or you have different views on the future of the European Union because you have some groups, for example, the European People's Party, that broadly support the idea of more European integration, maybe in a less enthusiastic way and with more prudence than maybe my Social Democratic group. But in the end, they want to maintain a strong and a large European Union in terms of being a strong institution. So there are differences that are difficult for them to combine. But it's true that on certain identitarian topics, they are bringing the forces together. And this is a problem today, but to be very frank, it depends on the elections. If the next important elections in Europe, for example, Sweden elections, most important Scandinavian country, it will happen in September, then you have Italy, France, the direction of these governments will determine a lot of the orientation of the European Parliament. Because to be frank, this Parliament is not so much more to the right than the previous ones, just a little bit more. But it's the attitude of the biggest center-right party, European People's Party, that has changed. They have been, in these first 2 years of this mandate, more prone to work with the extreme right because this was the atmosphere in general in Europe, a move to the right. If we see things changing also in the national elections, my bet, I am always saying this, is that the parliament will also realign to a more centrist positioning of the some of the governments. Because today, today we are in the moment of European integration history where we have more right-wing governments ever. So this thing could change with next elections. We will see what happens in, I would say, 8, 9 months.
And the final question then, Brandon, because you're in the Socialist Democrat group and you're the, for the moment, the second biggest group in the parliament. But as you just intimated, around the council table, right, of heads of government, heads of state, there's one or two socialist governments, maximum Spain, Denmark, some would contest
Malta.
that, and Malta, exactly. So
And also one of the Baltics.
what is the self-identification of the SND group? Do you still see yourselves as a major player, knowing that over the road, as it were, at the council, you are very,
Yes,
very much in a minority.
I can answer very simply. Yes, because we will have elections. And for example, in Sweden, it's very clear we are winning, we are back governing, and I'm sure we can win also in Italy. And I hope also in France there will be a lucky combination at the first round so that in the end we can beat Marine Le Pen.
Right. Okay. On that note, people can't see you, but you are actually smiling when you say that, Brando. We have to leave it there. Brando Benifei, thank you
Thank
very
you
much
very
for your
much.
time.
Thank you.